accession number 23827, reel 11.
John Street, reel 11. So you got a lift home in the Anson sometime.
Yes, and I would ring up a friend of mine who was still at Upwood, and he'd come and fetch me.
Right.
My wife was living in an airman's quarter. Mm-hmm. Although I was commissioned, they let me stay there, and the station was closing anyhow. The station was running down, so they didn't want the quarter, so I was lucky. I just stayed there, going home every weekend until I got my posting, which was to back to on this course. But there's no chance of getting a quarter there, so I used a little bit of influence I had. I rang up another officer I knew and said, do you know where I'm going to end up? And he said, Waddington.
Right.
So I got a quarter at Scampton,
right,
which was what they call, at the time, a headless family, families whose husband was doing something else. There was a lot of those there.
Right. What was the Vulcan course like then? What was the Vulcan course like?
Well, the Vulcan course is very hard.
What was so different or new about
it? Maths, I think, formulas in electronics, a thing I'd never really touched a lot of. I was having to learn from basic. I managed to get through it. I didn't shine like I did on perhaps on the other courses I got through. And I think also that I don't know whether, I think, sometimes when I think about it, I think I only went back on it because I'd started it. But I think that the fact I'd been away for 3 months on this course in Alaman, and then 6 months, I've been 9 months, but in that 9 months, they started to get a lot of young officers from who were already halfway through the course of their education. University was getting a bit easier to get to, you know, and they were getting an awful lot of university graduates. And I think they realised that, whereas back perhaps a year before, it was expedite to get NCOs commissioned and into the Vulcan force, and now they want such a necessity because they had an input from the universities of younger men. So I think they might have made their mind up then that I wasn't going to go on a squadron. But I didn't ever go on the Vulcan squadron.
Right.
I went to the OCU as an instructor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
that was at Waddington, was it?
At Waddington, yes.
How did you like that? Did it change?
I never instructed before, not as a job. I'd instructed as a part-time job. The CO say, go and instruct these people on this or that and the other. I found it interesting. I have a slight problem sometimes. Well, I certainly have a problem with my H's, I know that. And I did find that my biggest worry that I'd get the mick taken out of me sometimes, but I never ever did. I think, as I've always said right from when I started talking to you, that air crew are a different bunch of people to practically anybody else. A lot of them ended up in Barclays Bank air crew. And if you go to them, their club, their retirement club, all the NCOs gather together in a little group, and they don't talk bank, and they talk Air Force.
Yeah. So how long were you at Waddington?
As what?
As an instructor.
Oh, not very long, because they asked me if I'd do the short end course, which was a navigation course. And to be quite honest, by now I was up to there with courses, because I'd done the NBS, half the NBS course, Jeremy, the full NBS course, and I was Waddington, and I thought, oh God, no, I couldn't stand another course. And what I used to do, unknown to the Air Force, and never went in my book, every now and again, I used to go down and fly in the Canberras. Okay. I'd have a few days off, and I'd go and fly in the Canberras.
Well, they just sort of pop you on board where...
Yeah, the third man.
Yeah.
Two-man crew, you probably wear the third crew. And I learned a lot about the Canberras. And whether all knew about this, I don't know, but nobody ever said anything. Obviously, the CEO of the Canberra Quadrant knew it. Whether he said something to my CEO, because they were all pretty, they'd all been together, you know. And he said to me, how would you like to go on the Canberra flight? Now, we had a flight at there called the ILS flight, Instrument Landing System. It had two uses. One, it gave the second pilots, who were now coming through with no flying experience at all, apart from learning to fly at Cranwell or wherever it was they went, it would give them some chance to fly as a captain of the aircraft, to fly more or less in charge. Also, officers that were on a non-flying post were supposed to get 40 hours in a year to earn their flying pay. And we were, that was our secondary role, to let them come and fly, either as captains or as second pilots, and, or as a navigator, second navigator. And, but our main job was teaching ILS, which was the Instrument Landing System, to these Vulcan crews on the OCU. And we would give them lectures. I would lecture to them on the ILS system. And they would then go in, come to my squadron, my flight, and we would put them in an aircraft, and I would fly, navigate the aircraft on an ILS trip, mm-hmm. and get them used to. ILS was a go meter. They watched a go meter. Mm-hmm. If the needle went left, they went left. And so once I got them positioned in and watched where they went, because there was a possibility you could fly down the beam instead of up the beam if you weren't bright. They had to work out which way they were going. It was quite easy, actually, but they sometimes they didn't think about it. So I just have to watch them. Now we go and do a few trips, and then we had to go back. But we are also used for doing things. For instance, there was a court of inquiry on down at Malta, and they had to have an officer, senior officer from England. So they picked a group captain who I knew very well, and he rang me up and said, can I have a Canberra? And so I said, well, I had a lot of authority on the thing. I mean, there were only two officers.
Which squadron are you with?
It wasn't a squadron, it was an ILS flight.
Right.
Okay. We came under 230 OCU. So our basic top CO was the wing commander in charge of the OCU, a man called Dodd.
Right.
But he gave us a lot of freeway with this aircraft. And if you knew, you know, if you knew you were doing something that wasn't wrong, you could get away with it. So I said, yeah, I got an aircraft. He said, well, what I'll do, he said, I'll get you details to be the second man on this court of inquiry. Because I was a flight lieutenant, he said, and then we can fly down to Malta. And then and I said, that's fair enough. I think we can manage that. Because we had about eight aircraft.
Yeah.
And of course, when we got down there, it appeared that the court of inquiry was going to imply negligence of a man much senior to me. So I never did the court of inquiry, but I stayed there with him, and then I flew back.
Yeah. What was the inquiry about?
I don't know, because I never got on it. something had obviously happened.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about it before we got there, and he didn't talk about it afterwards, because I say, I think the wing commander flying there was implementing, got the blame, I think, part of the blame. But there were lots of things like that, and other times you'd get quite the Air Force was quite a good taskmaster. I mean, I remember once flying from we flew a boy home to Northern Ireland because his mother was ill, you know, all unofficial, but everybody knew about it, and
yeah.
You know, the Queen gave her a blessing. Well, actually, the Prime Minister gave us a day. He let us do what we wanted, basically, as long as we did our job.
So you stayed at Waddington?
And I stayed there for quite a while. And I haven't got the dates for this, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I stayed there for quite a while. And Again, I got a bit fed up. I realised the ILS flight wasn't going to go on forever. And I thought, I'm not getting any younger. I want to get in Transport Command. I would have really loved to go into Transport Command. And I had to go down to London for something. I can't remember what it was. And I was a flight lieutenant now. And I was wandering around headquarters down there in looking for something. And suddenly this feminine voice shouts at me. And she says something like, that takes me back a number of years. And I looked around and there was a wing officer. WIF, whatever it was. And I looked at her and I didn't really recognise her because she was fat and dumpy, unfortunately. Because she was older than me. I mean, I was in my 40s. Yeah, she must have been in her 50s, you see. Yeah. And suddenly, before she could get embarrassed, I realised who she was. And she was a flying officer when I was a flight lieutenant in Italy. And I had a few contacts in Italy, and one of my contacts was the Americans. So I was doing a... I didn't tell you about much about my tour in Italy, but I was did a ground tour in Italy. And I knew these Americans, and I had access to the PX. And ladies, of course, weren't looked after too well by the Air Force. They couldn't get fancy underwear through the stores and all that. So every now and again, I'd get a Land Rover and I'd take her and my wife off to the PX for the afternoon. And she was so pleased to see me. And she took me out to lunch and she said, what are you doing? So I forget what I was down there for. I got a feeling it was something to do with my eyes. I think they wanted to check my eyes or something. And I said, well, I told her what I was doing. I said, I want to get on Transport Command. I said, I'll see what I can do, she said. I'll see what I can do. So anyhow, we separate and I go home and I told my wife, she knew her, and I told my wife who I'd met, you know, and laugh about it. And she said, oh, she said, and I said, no, she's not aged, because she was a pretty girl when she was younger. Mind the uniforms didn't do much for the WAF, did they? But she was a mum looked like a mum, or a grandmum, but she was a single woman, of course. She never married. Anyhow, about a month later, I was in the phone went, and she rang me up from, she said, yeah, I got bad news for you. And I said, what's that? She said, well, when I checked, I couldn't find anything about you. And she said, I suddenly discovered it, she said, in the Bomber Command section. And so we had to bring your career up to date. And she said, you have never done a ground tour, a proper ground tour. So I said, oh. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, what have I got? So I kind of had about three choices. And I said, well, I'll do air traffic. So, lo and behold, within a month or two, I was posted on an air traffic course in Shawbury.
Shawbury?
Yeah.
Is that S-H-A-W, is it?
S-H-A-W-B-U-R-Y, Shawbury. It's up by Shrewsbury, right. And it was the air traffic empire. Mm-hmm. And I did an air traffic course.
Yeah.
And I was posted to Manby in Lincolnshire. And that was the most peculiar station in a way, because had a station commander, a group captain station commander, and all his people that looked after the station. And I had Idris, had the big Lincoln and Canberra that the RAF used for exploration stuff, used to do a lot of flying up around the Antarctic, the Arctic. And the Canberra, of course, they had one of those. They were involved in things like the air races and things they did. It was the Empire Air Armaments School, actually.
At Manby.
At Manby, yes. There was a comm flight, which you could get a little bit of flying in. They had an Anson's. And there was another, what they call a refresher flight, which was Chipmunks, which was used by pilots. But you could also get fly in those if you wanted to. But the Air Armament School was run by an Air Commodore. And it was Air Commodore Donison, a much loved and respected Battle of Britain pilot. We all knew him. Been married about 3 or 4 times, I don't know. Lovely man. Down to earth. And so was the station commander. The most interesting station to be on. And the flyer was done from Strubby, which flew Hawkers, Hunters at the time. And that's where the air traffic was established. And Manby was more or less a little, an airfield, which the special aircraft used to fly from, and you get a lot of circus and bumps and whatnot, and aircraft and simple. And they had a lot of trouble with running the station because the full-time air traffickers thought that if they got into a backwater, they'd lose out. We had no radar. It's purely in charge of a station and giving people. It was quite an important job. You did, the administration, you did more there, because, I mean, when the thing flew off to, I mean, I had to go from here up to Scotland and Scotland up to Scandinavia, Sweden, before it went off up to the Arctic. I mean, a lot of work to be done when that happened. Very, your circuit was busy with the small aircraft flying round and round.
So, how were you plotting? How were you plotting your traffic in your area?
Well, manually on boards, just writing up on boards in those days. Anyhow, as I say, they had a lot of trouble at Manby with people didn't want to go there. And I said to the CEO one day that I'd be prepared to go there, and as long as he gave me a title, I would go there. So I went there as Officer ICA Traffic Manby.
Right, officer?
Officer IC, Air Traffic Manby. And I was there all the time. I went back to Strubby about once every 6 months to show them I could still handle their jets. And it was a lovely life in a way. I mean, I was quite busy because I was the only officer there. I had some 21 WAFs under my command who were either in the operations room at Manby or down at Strubby, and of course also in my tower. Two or three airmen. Didn't do much night work. It was purely all day flying. And then eventually we got a ACR-7, which I learned to operate, which was a blind approach. But for this, normally I used to get an officer from the pool down at Strubby used to come up and do the ACR-7 work. They'd come up for the day.
They did my work?
That was ground radar. A circular radar scope. It would pick up the aircraft. Radar, as you know, can give both distance and height because they can work out the angles, and using Pythagoras it works out the height of an aircraft. And they would manoeuvre the aircraft into a position to let down, and eventually you would take him over on the other, which was just looking like this down the glide path, and you would get him to come down the glide path. Very elementary radar. I think he had to break off. If he couldn't see the airfield at, say, like 300 feet, he had to break off. It wasn't a ground approach. It wasn't like the ground approach that they had on other airfields. It's a caravan at the end of the runway sort of thing. It's had to move it around which runway you're on. ACR-7. I don't know what it stood for, ACR-7. Aircraft Recovery Mark 7, it was. But I was there until I used to get quite a lot of senior officers in. They'd come in their own aircraft, perhaps, the station Tiger Moth. There's still Tiger Moth there, or the Chasing Chipmunk, possibly. A lot of Camberas used to come in there. And one day, this one of the officers came up, and again, I recognised him from when he was a lad, sort of thing, and he was now quite senior. And we had a good long chat. I had him in my office. He gave him a cup of tea and a long chat. And he said, would you like to go back on flying? And I said, yes. Transport commander. He said, I can't do anything about that. I'm bomber commander. And so I got posted to Canberra's.
To Canberra's?
Canberra's, yeah.
Where was that?
Well, I had to go to Bassingbourne. Well, first of all, I had to go to... I had to go to Bassingbourne to do a refresher course because I hadn't flown, obviously, for about 4 or 5 years properly, only kind of as a seat or a camera. Yeah. So I had to do a navigation course, which I did. And then I went off to Bassingbourne to... Let me get me...
So the course was at...
It was a photo reconnaissance... OCU. Mm-hmm. And we were flying PR7s, two-man crew, and to my astonishment, of course, my pilot was about 21 years old, and I was 46, I think. Yeah. I was 40, I think, 42 possibly. Mm. And we got on like a house on fire.
Right.
He was a... He was an Australian, but served in the RAF. He had some good contacts because his uncle got quite high during the war, and he'd managed to keep these up. And then we went and met his uncle, and he and I were very, very close. And I think possibly I admired him as a pilot. He's quite a good pilot. He was a bit typical Australian. He didn't care much for rules and regs, so I had to guide him a little bit.
Yeah.
And
was this at Bassingbourne or was this on the course?
No, this was on the course at Bassingbourne. This was the OCU at Bassingbourne.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
How long was the course?
Oh no, it was. We went down to Thorny Island first to do our little refresher course. That's right.
Okay.
Went down to Thorny Island, did a short course there to get us back into the fly, and then we went to Bassingbourne to fly the Canberras.
Right.
And I discovered that basically what the RAF were doing is that practically every Canberra squadron, whether it was a PR squadron or a strike squadron, had got an older man. Because the average age of the aircrew was about 21, and They put an older man in practice. So I now knew that I could pick up the phone and speak to a friend of mine, a comrade of mine who was my age. It was on another station.
Yeah. Excellent. So how long were you at Bassingbourne?
It was quite a long course. And, of course, it was made longer by the fact that was the bad winter, 1961, I think, or 1960. Yeah. I'm not sure which.
62 to 63.
Was it? Yeah. So we were there, and it delayed us. I think it was a 14-week course, but it took a lot longer than 14 weeks. And then we came up for postings, and the man came down from Air Ministry. And because I had a boy now, my son was in the region of 16, 17, 18 years old. And he was at an agricultural school. And I thought that Germany would be a better bet for me than, and of course I got it quite easily because everybody else was after Malta, Cyprus or Singapore. Mm. So I got my post into Cyprus, to Germany quite easy.
Whereabouts in Germany?
I went to Bruggen. Mm-hmm. At least that's where I was supposed to, but Bruggen was being extended, being upgraded, and so although we were stationed at Bruggen, we were flying out of one of the other airfields.
Right.
I can't remember which one it was now.
Yeah.
But flew out another airfield. Mm-hmm. And that went on for about 3 months. So we were bussing up to there every morning. Or we'd stay there the night if we had an early flight. Mm. My wife went with me. I took her with me. And she lived in a hotel in Holland. Mm-hmm. Then I got some accommodation in a chalet in a holiday site not very far from Roermond on the Roermond. And she was quite happy there, But I go back to my wife a little bit. My wife was a very good cook, and she was a housewife. She had no interest in going to work. She made everything. She would go down the market, and she would buy, when we were in England, and she would make dance dresses for herself and also for her friends. Fantastic dresses. She always dressed the children herself, the girls. She always dressed the girls. Everything she made, and she cooked. She was a fantastic cook. And one of the things we used to have in the Air Force in those days, I don't think they got them now, was gourmet clubs. Mm-hmm. And there were two or three different ways we could do this. One, you'd have a small one, using one of the more higher rank or better off person's kitchen and having the food there. Or you would possibly be able to, one place, you used to use a room in the officer's mess. It had its own kitchen. I don't know what it was. It had a kitchen and it had a room, but it was never used, only by us.
The function suite.
And there were about, 30 or 40 members. And we were manned by the women. And they'd meet and they'd decide once a month, perhaps. And Mrs. America would say, well, I'll do an American dinner. Mm. And then, can I have some help? And my wife would always be straight in there. And by this time, well, I was this was I think at Waddington, I think. So I think when I was a commission. So she got through her NCO. When she was an NCO's wife, she used to use her friend, and she learned to cook English. We had a funny system in the married quarters there that you had the married quarters at a terrace, and that basically they were. Downstairs in two bedrooms upstairs, mm-hmm. and by altering the doors, you can make it a 3-by-1 bedroom house. And when we moved in first, we had the three bedrooms, and the woman downstairs next door to us was a Persian girl. My wife learned to cook curry from her, and she really learned how to cook, and she was very keen on cooking. And this gourmet club, of course. She got an expert at all sorts of it. Chinese, yeah, that she used to go in on them. And of course, she had her own Italian recipes. Mm.
So everyone kept pretty busy.
Yeah. So my wife was quite happy, and she'd be in the wife's club and things like that. And
she got a lot out of it, didn't she?
Eh?
She got a lot out of being an RAF wife, yeah. Were your family happy in Germany?
I think they were, yes. Unfortunately, my eldest boy, of course, wasn't. He was in England. And a long involved story, which I don't really know all the details on myself, but he gassed himself accidentally in the bathroom of the old farmhouse he was living in, the geezer. And he was wrongly diagnosed as being epileptic. So he lost his job, because he wanted to always be a farmer. Farm worker. I don't think it was a good choice, but he went to this agricultural college, but the bottom dropped out the farming market, because when we read the prospectus, they were selling them to Canada and Australia and New Zealand, but now, of course, Canada, Australia and New Zealand, India, for instance, they were getting their own nationals to do the job, so it wasn't a good job, but he came to live with us in Germany as well, and they enjoyed it.
Because,
as I say, he's very like me. He's very interested in.
Yeah.
Thing. And we lived in Rhine Ireland, which wasn't on the station, unfortunately. It's about 11 miles from the station, and I either used to motor in or go in by. We had a coach that ran back and forth. Yeah. My wife could walk to the Naffy. The big Naffy, the big super Naffy, to the hairdressers, whereas if she'd have lived on the station, it wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
And the kids, of course, could walk to school instead of going by bus.
Right, okay. John Street, end of Reel 11. John Street, Reel 12. So how long did you stay in Germany altogether?
About 5 years it was, right. I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that takes us up to what sort of. Towards 69, 70?
Yeah, and we came back from there, and I was posted again to a flying job. I flew I was posted to St Athens as a station nav officer, but again, it was a job that had been degraded and gone down. The post would be disestablished eventually because the RAF was changing in its way of doing things.
So they were closing lots of airfields, were they? They were closing lots of stations.
Yes, but they weren't closing that. It was just